David, you look absolutely terrific. Honestly. You've got like blue on. Well, Al, you're still mother says you're very conservative. Brooks, everything looks wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. This is the best thing to wear for today, you understand?
Yeah.
Because I don't like women in skirts. And the best thing is to wear pantyhose or some pants under a short skirt, I think. Then you have the pants under the skirt. And then you can pull the stockings up over the pants underneath the skirt.
Mm-hmm.
And you can always take off the skirt and use it as a cape. So I think this is the best costume for today.
Okay. I've met so many people where, in the process of filming, I've become friends. That's what it's all about, becoming friends with somebody. And that friendship is conveyed to the viewer so that they become friends with the people on the screen and become friends with people that they would never otherwise meet. You know, we have this wonderful expression, love thy neighbor, but how can you love thy neighbor if you don't meet them? And if you meet them through a documentary well made in this direct cinema fashion, then you know them. And know them, in many cases, better than you would ever know them by spending a good deal of time with them as well. But it's time very well spent.
That was, of course, Al Maisels, the now deceased pioneer of verite cinema. Or direct cinema, as he called it. It's a great loss. It's an acute loss. I'm actually quite moved and down by it. I mean, he lived a very long life. Al died Sunday night, March 7th, 2015, at the age of 88, I believe, unless I'm mistaken. And, of course, the first part of that clip was from his and his brother David's seminal film, Grey Gardens. That was Little Edie, who was talking to both the Maisels brothers, talk about direct cinema. She had quite a way of talking directly to them and to the camera. And then the second part was part of an interview from a couple of years ago I did with him for the podcast, episode number 180, if you want to hear the whole thing. I might do a little restoration, actually, because as I was digging it out and posting that clip, I had to clean up a lot of the audio, sounded pretty bad, because he was so soft-spoken. I guess he was about 86 when I met with him. And I met Al Maisels about 4 years ago, only 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. I can't recall exactly, and walked into a theater and a little early to an event, and he was sitting in the front row by himself. And I not met him. I recognized him, but I went up to him, and he was immediately warm and engaging and telling me anecdotes. And I, you know, of course, had questions for him about Gimme Shelter and Grey Gardens and, you know, a few other projects. And since that time, you know, there was over and over, I kept running into him. We talk. I interviewed him for a couple of written pieces I did. And then he came on the podcast, but I would see him at events because he was so ubiquitous. He loved to go to parties. He loved to go to events. He loved to support filmmakers. My goodness, he would support so many filmmakers. He had a cinema, which still, of course, exists, called the Maisel Cinema up in Harlem. I recommend, if you've not been there, to go. I've done a bunch of screenings up there under my Docularius film series, and used to talk to him about humor and love and compassion. He was those were his passions. And then he and his wife would have these annual holiday parties. And I kicked myself that was so busy at the end of the year that I didn't remember to sort of figure out when it was, because I would get invited normally. And this year I was just like, I forgot to ask about it because I didn't get an invitation. And so it slipped through the cracks, and I just, now, of course, I feel bad I didn't get that one extra time to say hello and give Al a hug and see how he was doing. But nevertheless, I feel very lucky to have known him in the capacity I did know him, and I can only recommend to go and check out his films, the ones he did with his brother and the subsequent films, because they're beautiful. And he has two works still to come out. One is called Iris, And that's a feature documentary. I saw it at the New York Film Festival last year. And then there's another documentary project that he was involved with other filmmakers about train travel and meeting people who are on a journey. I know he's not the only filmmaker on that project, but he was involved in it. And he actually talks about it, I think both of these projects on this interview, again, episode number 180, which I may go in and clean up and repost, but as it stands now, it needs restoration. So yes, go back and do check out his work. And rest in peace, Al Maisels. What a great guy. Dead at 88. Rest in peace. And my condolences, of course, to all of the family, his friends, and all the people that worked with him and closely and knew him over the decades. And so, yeah, it's a great loss. Well, to switch gears a little bit, sorry if it's a little abrupt, but you are listening to Film Wax Radio, episode number 278. My name is Adam Shartoff. I am actually just getting ready to leave for Austin, Texas as I record this. I only have a little bit of time before I have to hop out of here. But this is a really great episode. I have two documentary segments and one narrative segment. The first segment is Fareeha Zaman and Jeff Reichardt, who are partners in both life and work. They have made a couple of documentaries. One is called Remote Area Medical, which is as of right now, available on various digital platforms. If you have not heard of this documentary, it's one you want to really see. It deals with an organization of volunteer medical professionals who travel to very impoverished areas in America and set up like a weekend clinic, basically. In this case, the Remote Area Medical follows them on one weekend at this racetrack in Bristol, Tennessee. And this is, of course, what happens over that weekend. It's to Al Maisel's. It's a great documentary. It had its premiere, I think, at Full Frame, and then it also played many other festivals, including Tribeca Film Festival. And I highly recommend you listen to this segment and then go check out Remote Area Medical. They also have a second documentary, which is still kind of in the festival circuit, and that one's called This Time Next Year, about the devastation as a result of this, you know, Superstorm Sandy, and specifically on Long Beach Island off the New Jersey shore. This is about a specific community that was, of course, decimated by... I shouldn't say that, because, in fact, this is about how people still have hope and how many of the residents of this very tight community are not going to go down without a fight and are trying to rebuild their town. So check out this conversation coming up in just a couple of minutes and then see those films. The second segment today is Eric Steele, who made this film 10 years ago called The Bridge. And it is, in fact, on its 10th year anniversary. There's a new version of the film on Blu-ray, thanks to Kino Lorber. The bridge, of course, is referring to the Golden Gate Bridge, which over a course of a year, Eric Steele and his crew shot from various angles the Golden Gate Bridge specifically to catch suiciders. Now, it sounds very controversial and a bit exploitative. It's not, though, I can reassure you. If you listen to the conversation, we talk about that in great detail. But I've always wanted to have Eric on my podcast, and this seemed like a ripe time to talk to him. And what a great conversation it was. So that'll be the second one. Then I'm posting my conversation with A.D. Calvo, or as I call him, Alex. He is the director of this film, The Missing Girl. If you're a regular listener of Film Wax Radio, you know that I've been posting various segments over the last year of various actors, the editor, that's about it, of this independent film. I had been on this set in New London, Connecticut last summer, and I did all these interviews, and we're down to two left that I have not posted. The complicated part is that so far they've not been getting into some of the festivals that they would like to have, but there is still plenty of great opportunities to get into some major festivals, and we're looking good for one of the major festivals coming up. So this, of course, conversation doesn't get into festivals too much because this was recorded literally while they were shooting the film. He ducked in and he did this interview with me. Okay, so AD Calvo. We'll have one more episode up of the series soon with producer Mike Ryan, and we'll put that up shortly. I don't know exactly when. But okay, so again, you have Fariha Zaman and Jeff Reichardt with their films Remote Area Medical and This Time Next Year. Eric Steele with his film The Bridge, and AD Calvo, director of The Missing Girl. Let's go into my conversation with Fariha and Jeff right now.
I was raised on a farm and taught to take care of yourself, to allow somebody else to step in. That goes against what I was taught.
I do the best that I can.
Your children are sick. You have to decide whether to buy bread or take them to the doctor.
Welcome to America. We've cut back in places like Africa simply because we're overwhelmed with the need here.
All these people have been here since Wednesday night.
I worked at McDonald's for 9 hours. I've had 2 hours sleep since Thursday night.
We're all looking in life for what's real. These patients are real. Their needs are real.
I haven't been able to kiss my wife in over a year. That's pretty hard, man.
It's just too expensive to go to a dentist.
I need a mammogram. Make sure things are going okay.
Okay, who's got number one?
How long has it been since you had the doctor's visit?
Since I was a teenager.
Teenager?
I've got black lung real bad.
People volunteering their time to help us out, it's going to save my life.
We're coming. We're on our way.
There's such good people in this county.
Thank y'all so much.
I'm actually asleep now.
How can we move forward?
Get you hard.
But it's better than anything that you can do.
Okay, so we're talking today, happily, finally, right? Because we've been trying to get this scheduled for a little while, but it's always like that, and it's always worth it. So talking to Fariha Zaman and Jeff Reichardt, the documentary power couple behind such films as Remote Area Medical and This Time Next Year. I know, Jeff, you also have made Gerrymandering a few years ago, but I don't know, Fariha, were you also on that film as well?
We did not co-direct Gerrymandering. I actually was working full-time for the Flaherty Seminar.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, it was before I took the leap.
Oh.
But I did do various jobs on it. I think I'm in the credits 3 times or something like that.
How does that happen?
You know, we just
you're thanked. Kickstarter, thank you. Thank
this
you
was
for,
even pre-Kickstarter.
I did additional animation, uh-huh. And I did some shooting in addition to the nebulous, like, watching and discussing it constantly, which I think is part of what led to us working working together in the second round.
Yeah.
How'd you guys meet, by the way?
I
always go into the realm of the personal, but sure, I'm kind of curious, since you were also you're not only filmmaking partners, but you're also at least on these two projects, but you're also a couple.
Yeah, so we used to work at Magnolia Pictures together.
I
used to run PR and marketing for them, and Fariha worked in the acquisitions department, and you know, one thing led to another.
Okay.
It was a very scandalous office romance.
You had to leave because they had a strict policy against inner office.
Yeah, Magnolia is known for their very strict policies regarding socializing and dating.
I detect a note of irony in that.
They're known for their holiday Christmas party.
I've been to a few now. And as a matter of fact, I was at this one, just the one that passed. But there was no canoodling or whatever that I could detect.
No,
but
I happened to be leaving, but I think they're pretty supportive as long as you get your work right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is really nice to have you both. I saw Remote Area Medical because 2 years ago Tribeca Film Institute asked me to screen films for them and get feedback because they wanted to give out money to filmmakers. So, and yours, I mean, Remote Area Medical, I had no idea about it, and then I just put it on because I had to. and like totally blew me away. I mean, I was completely, you know, obviously swept into the story and found it just such a great idea for, you know, subject. So since then, it definitely been a filmmaker who I've wanted to bring on. So thanks.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I guess part of the reason we're talking is because Remote Area Medical is about to have its digital distribution, right? It's about to go into digital distribution, digital platform. And then also you do have this other film this time next year, so we can sort of talk about that. And you're splitting your time, I guess, since now you're going into the next wave of remote, right? You kind of have to work both films now.
It wasn't splitting our time so much as completely overlapping times, mm-hmm. because we started shooting this time next year when we were still editing Remote Area Medical, and that wasn't necessarily by choice. It's because this time next year is about this community in New Jersey, tiny barrier island.
Long Beach Island,
and the year after Hurricane Sandy. So there's no control over when the hurricane takes place, and we just had to start. We had to get in there. So it's been interesting having the whole lengthy film process overlap so much.
Yeah, bleeding into the next.
Yeah, we were going to festivals for Remote Area Medical while shooting this time next year, going to festivals for this time next year while working on the theatrical release of Remote Area Medical. It's been a pretty nutty couple of years. Gratifying, but pretty nuts.
But mostly gratifying, right?
Mostly gratifying. You know, it's lucky to have the chance to make two films in pretty close proximity. And one of them, for me, this time next year is where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And so it takes place where I grew up. And, you know, being able to spend a large portion of a year down in my hometown, essentially, making a movie, that felt pretty, you know, it felt like we kind of won the lottery.
Are you saying you grew up on Long Beach Island or
I didn't grow
nearby?
Up on Long Beach Island proper, but
where?
I grew up a
what
little
town?
Bit further south in a town called Northfield. But my aunt and my two cousins I'm very close to lived in Beach Haven.
Okay.
And so we would, like every weekend in the summers, all the holidays, we would kind of take the half-hour drive up to LBI, you know, head on over the causeway and down to Beach Haven. And now everyone has since moved off of the island, but they still live in Manahawkin, which is basically right over the bridge.
Okay. How far is this from Elberon?
I actually don't know. Where's Elberon?
I don't know. I thought it was near Long Beach, but maybe that's it. Is there a place called Long Beach?
There is a Long Beach, New Jersey.
Okay.
There's also a Long Beach in New York, too.
That I know. Yeah, Long Island.
When you didn't mention that, your mom grew up on the island also. So his, that whole side of the family.
So it's definitely.
And it has this like long family history for them. So basically, his mom used to live there, and when you see the film, you can see what a very small year-round community it is.
Mm-hmm.
You go in the summer and have this kind of picture of it, but then the rest of the year it's like very working-class families, you know, fishermen, people who run the mom-and-pop shops, and this is kind of their time off to live on this half-closed, freezing island in the middle of the ocean.
I wonder what the draw was to actually live there year-round, because for like seven months of the year, say, or eight.
The draw is you just need to be by the ocean. I mean, I think it takes a special kind of person to live on an island year-round. I noticed this because the Key West Film Festival showed this time next year, and it's another island community, very, very different because it's warm and southern, and you sit around
it's
drinking
tropical.
Rum and
Subtropical.
Go to the beach.
Yeah.
But there's still some similarity of like independent spirit, I think, that leads people to these locations if it's not the weather necessarily.
Right. Most of us live where we live for whatever reasons, but, you know, not necessarily tied to a suburb or, you know, or a particular town. We kind of move there because it's near where we work, and sometimes maybe near family for other practical purposes, but we choose to live based on economics and on, you know, other geographical schools and things of that. We just say, okay, this is it. But there is something to living near the sea, which is very particular for people, especially when you grow up around that. It doesn't sort of, it's hard to imagine, I guess, an alternative, and you constantly find yourself.
Yeah, a lot of the folks that are in this time next year and folks who didn't end up making the film, their story was essentially that they either grew up there or wanted to be there, and then they've just figured out how to make it work. And sometimes that means having your own business. Sometimes it means being a school teacher or a police officer or something like that. But in some cases, it is really just trying to cobble together different little jobs so we continue living by the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting what you're saying about place and why we choose to live where we do, because both films actually deal in ways that we didn't necessarily expect, because we were focused more on sort of the people and the social impact of what, you know, they were going through in moments of crisis. But I think at the heart of both stories is this idea of like that it's very human to be attached to place for reasons beyond economics or even safety, because they're choosing to live there in this time next year, despite the fact that they're at the whim of the ocean, and they're choosing to live there in remote area medical, despite the fact that it's economically depressed and, right. and very, very isolated. And people we yeah. spoke to in both films just kept saying like, well, I have to be here. This is my place. I have to be in the mountains. I have to be by the ocean.
Right.
And it's like a hard thing to wrap your mind around in modern times when you think, well, you go where you need to go, or it's more about yeah. your community. There is some like animal instinct that still makes us seek out certain kind of place, I think.
It's true. There might be different reasons why people feel compelled to stay where they do, because, I mean, in the case of Remote Air Medical, which we should say takes place in or around Bristol, Tennessee.
Yep.
At the Bristol Raceway racetrack is where, you know, this medical unit is set up for a long weekend, and many of the very poor, either unemployed or underemployed, uninsured for sure, people come for help, right? But you know, it's like where do you move? What, like, okay, yes, clearly there are probably other places, but you got to have a place to live, and you know, it's anyway, so it's complicated. It's not always so easy. So you kind of answered my question, Jeff, in terms of why you chose to do the Long Beach Island story, because you grew up in the community, so it was compelling to you. You felt an immediate, right? I'm sure there have been other similar, maybe there are other documentaries or shorts that have dealt with the aftermath of Sandy, right? Did you feel there was something else to it that you wanted to say, or?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we really thought that we saw a lot of documentation happening kind of during the storm, immediately after the storm, in the 2 months after. But then in New York especially.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But we felt that, you know, we sort of had this idea of, well, what happens, what does the next August look like? What is Memorial Day, which was so important to the local businesses? You know, can they get open for Memorial Day? Mm-hmm. What does the next fall look like? How does the anniversary feel? And so these are some of the questions and things we wanted to see that got us inspired to basically stay on LBI for, you know, the entire year, mm-hmm. and see how that looked. Because I think there are a lot of things that happen to people that you don't quite expect to realize, and things that they themselves don't quite expect to happen or realize until months and months and months pass.
And I think in addition to sort of our personal connection to the island, its small size and dependence on tourism and the ocean is very stark. That's it. That's what's going on there.
Right.
It's not like a city by the sea like Miami, which is, you know, dependent on the ocean, but
has
a larger network. Like, this is what they live on, and it's simultaneously what they, you know, are thrown into crisis by. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, as a result, it's also a community that is very, very in tune with the season. So it's not just the idea of the passage of time or the length of time it takes to recover, which is a big part of the story, but also this idea that, like, instantly the people in this community think, what am I going to do if my business isn't running in May? Like, if I'm not ready by Memorial Day weekend, I cannot live here. It's over.
Right. It's right. It's a huge pressure cooker of a situation. And were you surprised by any of the stories, or any of the were you surprised by anything that, you know, you learned through the conversations with the residents of the island?
You know, I think you know, we were surprised by some things, even though we didn't go down with the intention of, you know, finding something that nobody had ever seen before, really. Mm-hmm. But you know, we thought people would get into their homes a lot more quickly than they actually were getting into their homes. And that was a function of a number of different things, a lot of it dealing with government bureaucracy and mm-hmm. how monies were being released from the different agencies for different kinds of things. You know, so when we went to Jackie Tarafenko's house 3 days before the anniversary of the storm, and found that she and her husband, and these are both kind of these are senior citizens, they were living on the second floor of their home in three rooms.
Yeah, yeah.
With the
using
first
their bathroom as their kitchen.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, so, yeah. You know, we were surprised to see those kinds of things. But I think, you know, for us, it was really, you know, we thought, you know, regardless of this idea of, you know, that question of surprise, we just wanted to kind of immerse people in a community and see what it looked like and how it felt to be there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that surprised me was the effect of such a trauma on people who are otherwise kind of stable, because the first film we'd made together was about people who live in abject poverty. You know, there's no question about that. And this is a very different look. And I think a lot of times when documentary filmmakers go into a storm-affected community or natural disaster affected community, it's easier to immediately look at the people who are in most dire straits even before the storm, because there's an inherent pathos there. And this is about how even if you're kind of in like a firmly working class, middle class situation, one storm comes along and blows everything off its course. And even just looking at like how people felt differently about their homes, how their children were still having like post-traumatic stress disorder when, you know, there was a thunderstorm. It was like a more psychological exercise. And I didn't necessarily realize how deep those hurts go.
Yeah. But the overall experience was that people trusted you guys and were glad to talk, or open and willing anyway?
I think it took a little time. I mean, that's the interesting thing in terms of comparing the two films. Remote Area Medical was by design, you know, basically a three-day shoot. We did some before, we did some follow-up after, but the idea is that this one moment is so intense that people just open up because they're feeling emotional, and you have to create bonds really quickly. This time we had a little more time to do so. So I, when we first met people, honestly, they were still kind of in shock. Like, we'd go into their house and they were just looking around blankly, like, I can't believe this is the place where I lived.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that at that time, and we've talked about this with a lot of the people in the film, they were like, who are you guys? Like, what do you want? People are very generous. But I don't think they had an idea of like, the fact that we wanted to build a longer term relationship. It was just, you know, people are used to the news coming in after an event like that one.
Yeah, right.
And when we took the time, and I think we also were very cognizant of like the chemistry that existed between us and the subjects we were choosing, so it lended itself well to building a relationship. You know, we got so comfortable and were so grateful that they were really open with us. Like, we would come in and out of these people's homes like on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and we were We took our time, I'll put it that way, and just tried to be really aware of how they were responding to us.
It helped that I'm from there, and so we had some connections. Yeah, so a lot of the people that we found were folks that were recommended by my aunt or my cousin who teaches at the local high school.
Okay.
But, you know, that can only take you really so far. And one thing that we try to be really cognizant about when we're talking to anybody for a film is that, you know, is making sure that they're aware that we're interested in kind of the totality of their person as opposed to just what is most salient for the movie. And that comes in asking them all sorts of questions that don't have to do with, you know, we didn't just ask Joe Mangino about climate change for a year and a half. We didn't just ask Glenn Epps from Remote Area Medical about his health problems. You know, once people who you're interviewing start to realize that you're interested in them as a multifaceted thing and not just something that can be kind of plugged into a film, we found that we've tended to get, you know, we've gotten better interviews. We've created closer connections with people.
Or that they're defined by this disaster.
Sure.
That their lives are more than that.
That was sort of easier to tackle in this time next year, because there's a sense of, you know, why you can't just show how difficult life is during the storm if you can't also contrast it with, well, what is everything else? What is everything else in their life? What does a normal day look like? Mm-hmm. With Remote Area Medical, you know, that was something that we didn't realize until the edit process, really, where we started to work in all these stories that we'd heard, and it was pretty focused on the clinic, on health issues, and we're like, it's really doing this community a disservice to make it seem as though they are simply the sum of their worst struggles.
Right.
And that's why, you know, we sort of worked in some...
They came up with a term around this time where this movie came out, and I'm just remembering, didn't they? What was it called? Like poverty
porn?
Porn and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you had to battle against that.
I didn't feel that way about the people we interviewed on a personal level, and I didn't want it to seem that way in the film either.
Right.
And, you know, we worked in things where we showed some more of Bristol as a community. Mm-hmm. People make jokes. We left that in there, you know.
Right.
Even if it's kind of dark humor, that there's more going on even in the midst of a very frustrating experience.
Yeah. I mean, my response when I saw it was, you showed so much humanity. Sorry for the people listening. We're kind of oscillating between the two films. We're now talking about Remote Area Medical again. And I don't know if this was the case, or maybe your film just focused on all the dental patients. A lot of people went in just to have teeth pulled. And One thing that I learned and took away was, like, being able to smile, or you know, not to feel ashamed of your smile is huge in terms of your confidence and your ability to feel like you can go for a job interview or do the most simplest things that we take for granted, and the relief and pride that people felt once they were treated, you know.
Yeah, it was really something to see, you know, when we were there. And we did, there is a lot of dental work in the film because something like 80% of the people who go to a remote area medical clinic go there for dental work. But it was really important for us to weave that in the film in such a way that it's not just a gratuitous bloodbath of teeth or tooth after tooth coming out and being put into buckets. And, you know, we tried to make it, we were very careful to make sure that the first time you saw a tooth come out of the film, it was somebody that you knew her story. And so that way, as each of those teeth come out, you know what this means to her and what it's going to mean to her life because you've met her. Mm-hmm. If we'd just gone in, you know, kind of guns blazing and showed the whole dental operation right from the start, it sort of dehumanizes people, and that's not really what we're about.
Right, and then it becomes, again, their pathology. They become defined by that.
And the deeper ramifications of going without care for so long, that was the surprise for me on remote area medical.
We talked
about this time next year, but, you know, of course, first of all, I knew that, you know, our healthcare system is broken, but it was very different seeing people line up and the numbers that they did and thinking that every single town that this organization goes to has the same situation. But then it was hearing people talk about, you know, it's not just that I'm in pain, which is bad enough, which, you know, that's not good enough as it is, but that pain prevents me from feeling good about myself, from providing for my family, from getting a job, like your entire, you know, well-being is
systemic. So this organization was founded by Stan Brock. Is that his name? Stan Brock. He's a British,
eccentric,
self-made millionaire.
Oh, he's not rich at all. He drives no salary.
No, well, I didn't mean he made it. I was going to get to that. I thought he maybe just had a lot. He was sitting on a shitload of money.
No.
Then decided to do this thing and like just do it at a.
His Stan's story is fascinating. He left Britain in his teens to go be a cowboy in British Guiana, and he did that. He lived amongst the natives in the Amazon for any number of years. He was host of a Discovery Channel wildlife show for some time in the 80s. He starred in a couple of kind of like B exploitation action films in the late 70s. He's been kind of all over the map, but for whatever reason, this idea of, as he talks about in the film, of bringing medical care to people in remote areas stuck with him from his early 20s until, you know, 1985 when he founded the organization. And he started the group, you know, basically with, you know, kind of in some ways not, it's not unlike how it's continued to be run today. It's sort of a shoestring operation. You know, they take all sorts of donations.
A couple of dental chairs, a World War II airplane, and a dream.
Yeah. Say again?
What? It's had a couple of dental chairs, a World War II airplane, and a dream. It was just like some people gave him some stuff.
Right.
And he thought, well, I can fly a plane, and I know these communities, and I can maybe convince some people to come out and volunteer. And that was it.
Yeah, the first clinic they did in the United States, it was they put one dental chair in the back of a pickup truck and drove to a small town in Tennessee.
Yeah.
And they had a line. They had a line of people waiting to get access to that one dental chair over the course of the weekend.
Makes
they realized
sense.
There's a lot of need. Let's refocus our operation to do more work here in the States.
But it seems like no matter how big they grow, you know, and if they add an extra day or two, it's just they'll reach capacity, they'll overflow, there'll be too much. It doesn't matter if you have one chair in the back of a truck and you're driving into the town, you'll get way too many people on the line ultimately once word gets out. And they could see 500 people the first day or something.
It's like 500, I think 800
the second day.
Similar number the third day.
Yeah, but you could have
they're turning away like hundreds of people
every
day. And they're absolutely doing their best, even in terms of
people,
you know, getting a venue that's large enough to accommodate that sort of those numbers. That's why they're in a NASCAR speedway, as crazy and ironic as it is to be in this, you know, pleasure dome, and people are coming to get their teeth pulled out and their blood pressure checked. But I mean, that's exactly the point, and I think that's why we really made a conscious effort to show in the film that this is not a solution to a functional healthcare system. Mm-hmm. You know, we left in those failings, and the organization was very, you know, not that they had any sort of say over the edit, but we never heard anything from them along the lines of like, why do you have that moment where Stan walks away from the gate? Why did you include that moment where, you know, Val talks about how unhappy she is that she couldn't get her teeth finished?
Yeah.
Because they do an incredible job. They make people feel human in a situation in which they're having to take charity, and often very reluctantly take charity.
Sure.
But it's only a Band-Aid. You know, they go broad rather than deep because that is the best that they can do.
Yeah, and I understand Stan has got to be the guy that there's got to be somebody who just keeps the thing on point and going. He can't do the one-on-one conversation. I mean, maybe he ends up doing it, but I understand why, you know, early on in the film, some people who had been turned away for the first day were worried that, you know, if they didn't stay put in the parking lot, in the waiting in line, essentially, that they would lose their spot if they had, because a lot of them had to go. They had people waiting for them at home that were relying on them for being, for whatever. And they were had to just stay in their car otherwise. And so she wanted to confront Stan to find out if they could at least get like a something to keep them their place in line. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of, you know, he wouldn't even talk to her. And I kind of like, you know,
what else can he do?
If he did that with every single person, mm-hmm. there would be no operation.
Yeah, every single person who goes to one of those clinics has a pretty compelling reason to be there.
Yeah.
Nobody waits in a parking lot for 2 to 3 days for healthcare if they don't really, really need it.
Right.
And so, yeah, Stan has heard all of the stories. He'll continue to hear the stories, but right. they have to have some sort of a system in place to make sure the thing continues to function, or else it would just be total chaos.
Right. He has to focus on the bigger picture.
So the scene that you're referring to, basically when people show up for the clinic, they have to wait in a parking lot. It's first come, first served, which means that people are showing up for sometimes 4 or 5 days in advance.
Before the Friday night of this long weekend.
Yep. And
or this Thursday, whatever it is.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of times that somebody will drive in somebody else's spot if they leave, or you just missed a ticket cutoff and think, do I have to stay here? And, you know, these are people who can't afford the extra gas money or the time off work.
They don't always even have a car.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there are people who are literally camping out.
They're dropped off or something.
And I think what was the reason why we included that scene where this woman realizes, I'm not going to make it today. What do I do so that I make sure I'm first in line tomorrow, but I can still go to work today,
mm-hmm.
Is that I really felt equally compassionate for both sides.
Sure.
This woman has to be there. It's her one shot for the year to get some things taken care of. And the woman who's volunteering for Motor Area Medical and handing out tickets, that's a thankless job. She wakes up at 2 a.m., hands out tickets to people, knowing that she's going to have to be that person to disappoint hundreds after the last numbers put out. So it's one of those...
Takes a bit of fiber, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to solely focus on those that you gave the tickets to.
And this is something that we couldn't figure out how to convey in the film, but the woman who volunteers to hand out the tickets is actually married to the man you see later in the film, who becomes the denture maker's apprentice.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Yeah. So they're a powerhouse couple, really.
And people from this organization have to stay on message, like, all the time. Like, we're not going to see everybody. Mm-hmm. Not everybody here is going to be seen today, tomorrow, whatever. So if you're coming, you have to be mindful of that. I mean, if you don't tell people all the bad news at the top, you're going to have potential riots.
Yeah, but even thing is that even though in the film that we show some instances where people get frustrated, people get a little angry, you know, for the most part, the vast majority of people who come to remote area medical clinics are just so grateful and so thankful, not only to get the treatment. You know, obviously they need to get their blood pressure checked and all that kind of stuff, but the way that the doctors interact with them, they come out and say things like, no one has been so nice to me in so long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really great. It makes me feel human again. And that's one of the things that remote area medical does. It's not just about the healthcare. A lot of it's about respect, too.
Right. Right. It's I totally get that it's really just what anybody is looking for. So remote area medical, where did it premiere?
It premiered at Full Frame in 2013.
Full Frame. Okay. Do you have a broadcast, or is it?
It hasn't had broadcast yet. We're working on broadcast plans for later in 2015.
Okay.
But the theatrical release happened through Cinedigm in mm-hmm. November of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And then March 10th, as you referred to earlier, the March 10th is the date for digital DVD and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So that way people can go immediately and rent or purchase the film. And then this time next year, what's the premiered at Tribeca?
Premiered at Tribeca 2014.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, we're still playing a few more festivals mm-hmm. and trying to figure out what our distribution plans are for it mm-hmm. at this point. So, but hopefully widespread availability later in 2015.
I'm sure. What do you have coming up for the film? Do you have a festival you can announce, or one or two?
I think the next festival we're playing is the River Run Film Festival.
Oh, where's that?
Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Okay. It's an amazing festival, and that's going to be in April.
Mm-hmm. I think you guys played remote area. I don't know if you were there, but you went to the Hell's Half Mile.
Oh, yeah. They showed us at Hell's Half Mile. We won a bunch of awards there, actually.
Oh. Yeah, I was there for that when it played there.
I wish we had been there. I heard it's amazing.
It is amazing.
Yeah,
it's
we were
really
lucky
cool
enough
festival.
To, I think, have multiple festivals happening. And Sometimes we had to choose.
Sure, of course. Yeah. It's always a choice.
Which is good because it's good that there's two of us because sometimes we've also been able to split up. But yeah. I think especially for remote area medical, so because Jeff and I have a distribution background, we've traveled to festivals before. Mm-hmm. It's very different going with a film. It's really nice to have this community of other filmmakers. And there are a lot who, you know, basically when remote area medical came out, I was like just about to turn 30 and it was my first film. And I think there were a lot of other first-time documentary filmmakers who were right around that age doing this festival circuit for the first time. And it felt like this like incredible roving summer camp.
Yes, I could see that.
And we really learned to love regional festivals.
Mm. Yeah.
Which, as you know, we had before, but going as a filmmaker, I think, you know, they really, there's often a more distinct personality. They really take care of you. And for the films that we made.
And the community comes out.
The community comes out. And for the films that we made, it really made sense as well, because it's all about respecting smaller rural communities.
Right. They're both about very much they're films about communities. And what do you find is the, I don't know, upside or what have you, between, let's say, a documentary festival versus, like, Full Frame is a documentary film festival, as opposed to, say, that other one where you're, this time next year premiered? No, but which is more of a general interest or, generalized?
At least I find it's not so much a distinction between doc and more general interest doc and narrative festivals. It really comes down to, you know, what's the size of the festival in relation to the place where it is, and how much work do they do to make sure that the festival reflects the spirit of the community in which it's in? I think as festivals get larger and larger and try and attract more and more people, they somehow maybe lose a bit of the character of the place that they come from.
Mm.
Whereas River Run, in Winston-Salem, it is all Winston-Salem. They do events all over town in historic places.
Right.
You know, we took this time next year to the Cucullorus Film Festival in Wilmington, North Carolina, and that is as quirky as that town is.
Festival's name suggests.
Yeah, and so I think, and Cucullorus shows narratives, experimental films, and docs as well. And so, but, that felt like a community there.
Right. At the River Run, is that what it's called? Do you get free cigarettes?
No. Did they give us underwear?
There was the
underwear.
The Hanes factory is there. And there was also a lot of moonshine. Like, all of the events have this really high-end moonshine.
Maybe there's a history of moonshine.
Yeah, there is. And I think that there's, like, a NASCAR guy, like a NASCAR racer who and is now famous for making this moonshine. So that's, like, a little bit of a connection for us.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I like about doc festivals, and I don't think this can't be fostered in festivals that show both kinds of films, but I love that they basically help foster a love and understanding of documentary films in the communities in which they are. So, for example, like True False or Camden, you know, both of those programmers have, you know, talked to us about how the first year was maybe tough going. People didn't necessarily know how to watch these films en masse. They'd watch a couple of documentaries a year, whatever had, you know, made the Oscar list or whatever.
Yeah, right.
But
you're talking about
time,
the communities of the where these festivals are. Camden, Maine, being one, and what's the town
is Columbia,
Missouri.
Missouri?
Yeah,
yeah, which also has an all-women's film festival called Citizen Jane, which has also played both of our films.
Huh.
So this is like a small community that supports two kind of niche festivals. And I think the way that they do that is by not talking down to the community and assuming that a doc festival would never work.
Right.
And saying, you know, if we build it, they'll come, basically.
Well, as a matter of fact, when I was at True False 2 years ago, I interviewed people. I never did this before, but I actually started just interviewing people in the like community. I went to a restaurant just to get myself a, you know, bite, and I ended up talking to people. So, and, you know, and they were exactly as you put it. They were, you know, so supportive and behind the festival and, you know, thought it was the greatest thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that's a pretty specific type of documentary.
Yeah, they're showing, you know, some pretty, you know, non-mainstream docs. You know, they will show docs that end up being shortlisted for the Academy Awards and stuff like that, but they're also showing international docs that are maybe hybrid forms.
Experimental,
things like that. And you go to the screenings and everything is full because people just have such faith in the programmers at this point They know they're not going to go too far wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that at the best fests, like a River Run, like a Kukulorus, or maybe Traverse City or something like that, people just have such faith in the programming that they just basically say, well, when am I free?
Mm-hmm.
And then they pick movies based on that.
Right, great. Well, again, the films, both of which we've been talking about, one of which you can see right now, it's called Remote Area Medical, and it's on various digital platforms, I'm sure, including iTunes, since they all seem to end up on iTunes, and on demand.
It should be on some on-demand platforms, and for folks who like Netflix streaming, it'll be June.
Okay, very good. So, and then stay tuned for more details regarding this time next year, the Long Beach Island / Sandy Dock, if I have to reduce it to those terms.
Yeah.
So, great. And I don't suppose you probably have a number of ideas for things in the works, is my guess, because you seem to be...
Oh, you always pass it to me.
you don't have to talk about
it. Yeah, no. So, actually, this year, people are like, oh, you're not shooting something right now? Because the last two were so back-to-back, it actually feels like you're just supposed to do that, but that's actually crazy. So, we're developing a film that we're hoping to shoot starting next January, and it's about a town in Texas called Luling. Luling. And basically, it's like 45 minutes outside of Austin. Uh-huh. Jeff and I only ended up there because we went early for South By 1 year, and they have a really great barbecue place. So we drove out there for barbecue. And as soon as we drove in, it just has this feel. You kind of immediately sense that it's an oil town, but just on the way down. There's like some, you know, empty burnout pumps, a lot of abandoned buildings, and yet, you know, there's obviously still a residential community in the area. And as we were walking around, we noticed all these posters that were like handmade, covered in glitter, featuring, you know, some local high school girl, and it said, vote whoever for Watermelon Thump Queen. It's like, what is Watermelon Thump Queen? Basically, this town's one continued claim to fame is a watermelon festival that they do in June, and the jewel of the event is crowning a high school senior woman, the Watermelon Thump Queen. So basically, we want to go live there for a few months and film these pageant hopefuls, and it's a way of looking at what it's like to grow up in this kind of town through the eyes of, you know, these young women.
Right. And the ever-changing economy.
Yeah, and the ever-changing sort of racial diversity in towns like this, because the pageant dates back to the 50s, I think, and it used to be all these, like, you know, like Caucasian women of German descent, basically, and now the town is, you know, very, very different. There's a big Latino community, Mexican community, African-American community. Yeah, so it's sort of similarly looking at a very specific regional community in America, and we really wanted to do that through the eyes of one of the most overlooked demographics in our society.
Have you had a chance to I don't think you could have, because I think it's just had its world premiere at Sundance, but the Bross Brothers' new film, Western.
Really excited about Western. We like their work a lot.
Yeah, me too.
And I've read a little bit about Western, and it sounds pretty special.
Yeah. A little plug for them.
I'd be happy to plug for them anyway.
Well, thank you both for returning my sense of enthusiasm when I ran into you a few weeks ago, and I'm glad it timed out well, and we'll definitely be supporting and promoting all the forthcoming releases of your films, and you're always welcome back. We'll do it again soon.
Cool. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
How long has it been since you had the doctor's business?
Since I was a teenager.
Teenager?
I've got black lung real bad.
People volunteering their time to help us out, it's going to save my life.
We're coming. We're on our way.
There's such good people in this county.
Thank y'all so much.
I'm actually asleep now.
How can we move forward?
Get your heart.
But it's better than anything that you can do.
Eric Steele, I met him when his subsequent film has only made one other documentary since The Bridge. It's called Kiss the Water. He's gotten into producing. He produced Julie and Julia back in 2009. So he's still quite busy, but he made this movie, Kiss the Water. It was at Tribeca 2 or 3 years ago, I think 2 years ago, and I did a Q&A with him and his editor, Sabine Cranbuehl, This is, of course, a movie that goes back to 2006, The Bridge. It is one of my favorite all-time films. So I was really excited to talk to him about it and ask him all these questions that I had building up. So here is my conversation with Eric Steele.
Hey, Adam.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thanks. I think we met at Tribeca, right? At the film festival. On your
you introduced my movie. You introduced Kiss the Water there.
Yeah, and we did a Q&A with Sabine.
Right, exactly.
So Kino Lorber is going to reissue The Bridge in the spring?
Yeah.
Basically, and it's going to be, I guess they're going to do maybe a Blu-ray and all that.
I think they are reissuing the DVD. They are... You know, putting it back online, it's now sort of been offline for a bit. But I think the most significant thing is that they're doing a big educational service outreach for the film for university libraries and universities and libraries.
In terms of a suicide prevention, or it just likely a tool for more open discussions about depression and other mental illness?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is, I mean, you know, when the movie first came out, I think there was so much talk about how, quote unquote, controversial it was. And I think people, people were pretty quick to sort of rush in and say, oh, you know, this is an invasion of privacy, or this is too much, or this is too graphic, or this is too
snuffy.
Yes, snuffy. And at the same time, I think there were people then who were saying, look, you know, this really is an incredibly intimate and pretty fair-minded, you know, look at suicide, which is just, it's just the taboo is so strong that's what the reaction was from. And I think time has sort of, at least in my mind, proven the value even more of the film. I mean, I think it did right away change the dialogue about suicide and mental illness and sort of take it out of the dark and put it in right in front of people. But you know, the real measure, I guess, for any documentary, I didn't set out with an agenda. I really just wanted to show something, and you know, 10 years later, the Golden Gate Bridge is about to begin construction on these suicide prevention net systems, which in 2005, it was nowhere near a possibility. It was not even on the table. It just was a non-issue. So I think in a lot of ways, that's like the proof of the pudding, right?
Right. Wouldn't it be more helpful, though, to have a battery of like therapists at the bridge rather than the netting? I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's like, if somebody's set on doing it, won't they just find another?
Yeah, I think I think what they've learned over time is that having easy access to a means to end your life is probably the thing that's most easily fixed. I mean, sort of related to gun control and prescription drug controls. I mean, the feeling depressed or suicidal is somewhat different than actually being in that very small window where you have a plan. You know, it's like a rocket ship. The planning of it and the talking about it can go on for a long time, but liftoff is only 10 seconds.
Right.
And I think that window, if you can close down the windows, doctors feel pretty strongly that they then have a much better chance of sort of helping people get over the intensity of those feelings.
Right.
I mean, I do think that, I mean, look, it goes hand in hand with how mental health has been sidelined, you know, in all these discussions. But this is, it's still an important, you know, it's just an important place to take a position to say that we care about these people enough to protect them even if it's protecting them from themselves.
Yeah, right. That it's actually the municipality or whatever, the state, I don't know who's doing it, but it's there's a mindfulness to this issue that, yeah, it's not just being swept under the rug or what have you. Yeah, I could see that. That does send out a powerful statement.
Yeah. You know, the genesis of the film came from two places. The first that I was sitting at my desk when the World Trade Center towers were hit, and I could see, you know, with my own eyes, I could see people jumping out of the buildings, you know, rather than die in the inferno. And then a few years later, I read Tad Friend's article in The New Yorker about the Golden Gate Bridge and their sort of ongoing resistance to putting up any kind of suicide barriers. And I sort of put the two together, you know, because in Tad's article, it said that someone jumped off the bridge to their death every 2 weeks. I figured if I watched the bridge for a long enough period of time, I would or might be able to see things that nobody had really ever seen before, because, you know, most of the time suicide takes place out of sight. I mean, deliberately, where nobody can see you. And here it was taking place, you know, in broad daylight at a national iconic monument. And so what we did was we set up cameras, wide angle and telephoto, manned and unmanned cameras at two locations, and filmed the Golden Gate Bridge for an entire year. I mean, every daylight moment from January 1st, 2004 until December 31st. And in the process over that year, 24 people ended their lives at the bridge, and we witnessed great many of them and interceded on, you know, wherever we possibly could. And then over the next period of time, I went and tracked down pretty much every person who had almost any primary connection to those people. So that was friends and family and witnesses and, you know, people who were driving on the bridge at that moment or kiteboarding underneath or on a tour boat or
right
or whatever. And from that, I, you know, that's...
Those are the interstitials.
Right.
Yeah. You said earlier you tried to intercede when you could. What did you guys actually, because I assume it was just you alone, but what did you do?
We actually had a crew of about 10 people who worked alternating shifts. And so there were always two people working at all times, one on the north side of the bridge and one on the south side of the bridge. And we were in very close contact, you know, over walkie-talkies and cell phones. And I mean, I think one of the things that we realized right away was that if you simply profiled people based on what they look like, I mean, we had no sound on the bridge and we were looking through, you know, through a viewfinder that was about the size of a packet of sugar. So we were just really reading, you know, like body language of people as they walked on and off the bridge. And, you know, I mean, if you said, oh, there's someone who's crying or there's someone who's pacing back and forth, and you said, yeah, oh, you know, I'm going to call the bridge district now, we would have been, you know, like Peter and the Wolf. So we had to have a sort of set of guidelines, you know, for ourselves, which was that at any moment that we thought someone was making a move to climb up onto the rail or over the rail or doing something that seemed so much part of that, you know, like the countdown to something. I mean, we thought if someone were taking off their shoes or if someone, you know, took their wallet out of their pocket and put it down on the pathway, or if, you know, someone, you know, one person we saw, you know, throw a laptop into the bay. I mean, I think at any moment that we saw anything like that, we instantly called the Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, everybody had that number on their their speed dial.
Wow. Okay.
On their cell phone. And so from that moment on, I mean, we were half a mile away from the bridge. And so from that moment, it really was up to how quickly the highway patrolman or bridge officers could respond and how long the person stood on the rail before they he or she decided
to
jump or not.
But the idea was, did you consciously choose to do that? You were going to come from a verite place in the general scheme of things, right? That you, I don't know if that even makes sense, this question now, because you do have then you do have your interviews with as you mentioned earlier, with friends, family, witnesses. Actually, I think you described it quite well.
Well, I think it was never really in question, but I can tell you that it was something that it felt like we needed as a, you know, or I needed to, as a director, talk about with my crew, which was that we were all sort of aware of the verite notion of, you know, being sort of silent witnesses to experiences and sort of capturing things on film. But in this case, I think there was really no question ever really that we were human beings first and foremost, and that we were filmmakers second. So there was no like, oh, it, you know, there was no doubt that the first thing you were supposed to do was call for help. And the second thing you were supposed to do was call your teammate. And then the next thing on the list was, oh, if you are so lucky that you have this in your viewfinder, or, you know, then do your best.
Right.
I mean, but there was never any moment where it was like, oh, the thing to do is get the shot and forget about our moral obligations. I mean, I think people confuse some of the footage in the film because they don't understand how it's been edited together, and that there were teams of people working and not just one person working.
Now, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall. There must have been some pretty, I'm guessing, pretty intense conversations among the crew, you know, about the ethics and the, you know, people's, you know, feelings about it. And, you know, what was the right approach? Because on one hand, I can see that, you know, you have very specific people that are, whose lives you might be able to intervene, as you said, and did, in fact. And then there's a broader picture, which is this is a really important story to tell and may help others, you know.
Yeah, I think.
And family members, even just family members in terms of understanding, or people that, you know, don't understand it. Maybe this will give them some deeper insight to what those who were committing or considering suicide were thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think I tried as best as I could to be the holder of the ethical question marks. I mean, I think I knew I probably couldn't tell the Park District that I was making a movie about suicide, so I didn't lead with that in my permit application. I said I was, you know, I wanted to film The Bridge for an entire year, and I never directly said to the Golden Gate Bridge District that you know, we were making a movie about the suicides. We were always the first ones, you know, we were like the eyes on the bridge at all times, and we were the first ones to call to alert them in almost every instance in an entire year. So it's not like they didn't know, but those were ethical decisions that were based on a sort of larger concern, which was that I was worried that given other things that I knew about suicide at the Golden Gate Bridge, that if I advertised or alerted the authorities or the media to what we were doing going in, that someone who wasn't thinking clearly would see the presence of our cameras there as some sort of opportunity to be immortalized on film, you know, as they were ending their lives. And that was a risk that I wanted to take off the table right away. And so I did, you know, I mean, I had to interview my crew in a very top secret offsite way. I mean, nothing like Laura Poitras, but not dissimilar. I mean, I think there was a sense of mission, you know, as you say, of trying to get out a story that nobody had, in my opinion, been brave enough to tell. And so I think the crew believed in it as an act of bravery. And I think the fact that at the same time, every one of my crew members over the course of the year, you know, made a phone call or took some action that helped save someone from jumping. And I think there just aren't a lot of, I mean, I think, you know, incidents happen on film shoots, but I don't think an entire crew walks away at the end of the year usually feeling like, wow, I not only saved someone's life, but I helped open up a dark corner of, you know, human experience for better discussion.
Yeah. And do you still get requests to appear for like screenings of The Bridge?
You know, I do not as much, in part because at some point I felt like the movie spoke for itself and that I had said almost everything that there was to say about it and that I needed to continue to practice the art of filmmaking rather than talking about it. And, you know, the odd part is that it happened in the aftermath of all this. I produced Julie and Julia, and, you know, we were sort of on that award circuit trail for a while. And I remember we were at an event, I think it was the Golden Globes, and Monique had made Precious that year, and she sat down next to me, kind of, she was exhausted. We had never met. And she said, oh God, I just don't want to talk about this anymore. And it really was the moment I said, yeah, I mean, why should I talk? I really wanted to make movies and not talk about them. So
I understand.
And then when you start to turn down requests, then that gets around that you don't do them anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, whoever is coordinating that for you, if there is somebody, they're going to take, you know, interpret it that way pretty quick. It sounds as though with this new push education-wise, you might be opening up to it again, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's things that have been learned in the world because of the film. I mean, you know, like if you looked at a newspaper, a major metropolitan newspaper in 2004, in almost any city in America, I bet you would have been very hard-pressed to see mention even of suicide anywhere in the paper. And I think now, you know, the word has been, I mean, it's still taboo, but it's not taboo to put it in a newspaper and to have a conversation about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that change has, I mean, I don't know where we fit on, where the film fits on the equation, but I do think the film helped change that. I think that's an important lesson in terms of what we are able to talk about. I mean, how to talk about things that people are uncomfortable with is always a challenge. And so I think the application of that beyond suicide and mental illness is probably valid to talk about as something new. I think as a civics lesson, in a way, what was really remarkable is that all of the families and the mental health advocates and people who cared in San Francisco really rallied, or the film helped them rally together in a way that put an enormous amount of pressure on the Golden Gate Bridge District, which was a pretty dictatorial, unresponsive, you know, transportation authority, a little bit like the MTA in New York or the, you know,
yeah,
Port Authority. And the fact that citizens actually won in this case, you know, even when there's still a huge sentiment in San Francisco that says, oh, why should we change our iconic monument just because a few people are ending their lives there. I think the right thing was done, and that doesn't happen very often. I mean, I think there are so many examples of where people talk about something for a little while and then there's not a huge sea change. I mean, gun control, I mean, after what happened in Connecticut, it's not like that produced the change. You know, I don't know. I mean, like Citizen Four, I love the movie. I just don't know how it might or might not bring about change. I mean,
Well, not single-handedly.
Well, no, but in terms of sparking the community most affected, or, you know, some body of the population big enough to bring about change. And maybe because it really only, you know, as you say, the Golden Gate Bridge you know, you're talking about 24 or 34 or 44 deaths a year, you know, out of a few, several thousand suicides in this country, or, you know, it's the tip of an iceberg, but it's a significant one. And so maybe that's just the scale. I mean, today I read that the CEO of SeaWorld stepped down, and I'm sure that's largely because of the pressure from Blackfish. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, no, it's wonderful when you see these things happening. Yeah. And I agree with you. Yeah. I think the documentary definitely has the potential impacting, you know, our culture like that. You know, and I think, but it's also, it's relative too, you know, so an government agency is a, maybe a little bit bigger of a thing to conquer. And the gun lobby, I mean, the gun culture has a very, very powerful lobby, which even if the Port Authority in San Francisco or whatever authority runs the bridge is powerful, it's probably not quite as effective lobbying agency. So, you know, I mean, I think it's a, like, so there might need to be a couple of citizen fours potentially, but if it wins an Oscar, that could make a big difference too.
Yeah, I mean, I
because a lot more people will see it.
Yeah, and I do think that it is as you say. It's some of it is just about the scale. I mean, it's like it's much easier to bring about change in a small way. But I do think, I mean, I think that's what I was trying to say, is that if you go to any newspaper now in any part of the country, you will read certainly once a week about incidents of suicide, whether it's in the military or suicide bombers, or, you know, these school shootings that also involve suicides. I mean, it's sort of taken, it's like the ice pick is in the ice now.
Yes, right. Understood. Yeah. So, right, the crack might be small, but it's starting. I got it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Eric, it was great to talk to you, and hopefully next time in person, but this was fine.
Oh, good. I'm glad. So I hope my dogs weren't whining in the background. They
No.
And tend I got to cry when they hear people talking that they don't see.
Have a great vacation, or we're
no, this is I'm
working.
I'm a snowbird, so I'm going to go and stay down for a couple of months. So.
Gotcha.
I'll be back. Okay. All right. Thanks. Well,
have a good break then.
Okay.
Again, The Missing Girl is essentially a story about a lonely middle-aged collectible store, shop owner rather, in New London, Connecticut, played by Robert Longstreet. He hires a young woman named Ellie, I think, to help him, and she is a budding graphic novelist on her own. She gets called to Brooklyn for a job interview doing, you know, illustrating. And for one reason or another, she doesn't connect with Robert's character. And so he all of a sudden gets very, very worked up over the fact that she's missing. And his imagination gets carried away. And all of a sudden he suspects foul play. And he goes on to investigate and breaking and entering and all these kind of fights. So it's a kind of a dark comedy. It's a little bit, a tiny percentage of a genre nature to it, but it's by and large a true indie film, and it's terrific. It's called The Missing Girl. It's about to hit the festivals, so you're not going to see it, but this is, again, part of a series I've done for Life on the Set, and we're going to do, again, my conversation with, after A.D. Calvo, we're going to go to one in a few weeks with the producer of the film, Mike Ryan, and then I guess maybe I'll try to find another film to do the same thing with. That's it. So let's go to my conversation with my friend Alex, or A.D. Calvo. So welcome, AD, the podcast, and thank you for including me and inviting me as a group onto the set. It's the first time I've done anything like this, so I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. We're very happy to have you.
Actually, Michael Taylor, who's the editor on the film and who's here during the production, he just was also talking about how this is like your third collaboration. And
this is our third film together, yes. Yeah.
So there's some sort of synergy there. Yes. Some sort of.
Yeah, I really enjoy working with him.
Where, mm-hmm. Yeah, is it helpful to have the editor actively involved in the construction of the film during the entire process?
I've included with this film, The Missing Girl, he's been involved since very early drafts of the script and would send me feedback even at the script level. Yes. And this is my first film that I've had an editor cutting while we're shooting. And that's a luxury and I'm going to call it a major insurance policy because it gives you this feeling like you got everything, or if you didn't get everything, you still have time to go back and get a shot you might have missed. And you know your data's good. And just like these little things that may keep you up at night if you're not cutting or really scrutinizing the footage during production.
You're afraid you're going to miss choices. Yes. You wouldn't have caught, and then you're going to have to go, you know, maybe go back, and nobody's going to want to do that. You may not get the actor, the budget won't allow for it,
absolutely.
Potentially. Then you have to start making other decisions based on those limitations now that you've created for yourself.
Absolutely. And even tonight, we're going back to reshoot something that I would have never had without Michael here. So definitely mm-hmm. good, a nice luxury to have. I feel privileged to be able to do that. And you get to a rough cut much faster too, which is nice.
Right. This is your first, like, you've made a series of genre pictures.
That is correct.
If I, you know, not to be reductive, but but there have been, you've made some horror films.
That's right. Yes.
And this is a first time where you've, is the word delineated?
Yeah, my second film, I did a little film that was kind of more in the drama world about a girl that has a doll that she talks to as if it's her dead mom, and it's kind of weird, and it was inspired by the Anthony Hopkins films, a film from the 70s, Magic.
I remember that.
Where he played a ventriloquist.
Sure.
And that had a lot of drama elements to it. But that film hasn't even been released. It was very small to have a sales agent that isn't really like releasing it for some reason. And I haven't had the energy to even go back and deal with that. That's a difficult thing when you spend so much time on something and then the film doesn't get released.
Oh, sure.
So it's not.
Do you ever have an opportunity to go back and try to get the, salvage that? Like, for instance, should The Missing Girl just catch and get a lot of good press and attention and do well? Are you then in a position where you can now use that and go try to get that other film?
I think
out of
the other one,
Limbo, and then you may be able to do something like on a Fandor,
exactly,
which just happens to be my sponsor. But you know, these guys
would totally put it out anywhere this point, just so at least it could be seen. There's like a Russian torrent out there. That's horrible because it's like dubbed in Russian and they cut out, they like zoomed in to give it like a different aspect ratio.
Yes, of course. Yes, yes.
So it's like
I love how they do that.
at least I like to get a nice widescreen 1.8. It's a 1.35. Does that sound right? Aspect ratio, the scope.
I want to see that, or 1.38 or something. Yeah,
it's like the skinny one with the big letter box.
Yes, yes.
There's one. That's the way it's meant to be seen, and they like punched in and did like
got rid of the letter box. Yeah.
So that film didn't get released. So yeah, it was a little bit genre. So this is my first non-horror film, and but it has some genre elements and some dream sequences that were kind of inspired from my work in genre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Five or six dream sequences.
Right. And you're also collaborating this film with, we mentioned Michael Taylor, and you're also collaborating with Mike Ryan, who is a true visionary producer.
I'm very, this is the first time I've done a film where I had like, I'm going to say the, for lack of a better word, a creative barometer that I really feel I trust at the producer level. I'm just in awe of his films, like Old Joy or the comedy. They have this realism and this kind of non-pretentious kind of non-manipulative quality to them.
Yeah.
That I feel all my work up until now has been very manipulative and heavy-handed. And luckily, through Michael Taylor, I met Mike Ryan. Through Michael Taylor and two assistant editors that Michael Taylor used to work with, Sanji and Ranju, they've also colored a couple of my films. I met Mike through those guys, and the first draft of this script got to him, and he liked it and just helped me pull out all the manipulative stuff. I was just like,
gotcha.
The first draft and the current draft are very different stories. The first draft was very traditional. Oh, I'm going to hold something over on the audience and there's going to be some big surprise. And I think working with Mike has been, I told him once, he's kind of like a therapist because he makes me see things in the writing that I don't really see myself. And it's like, yeah. He lets me stand back and see things that sometimes you just need someone to point out to you. And I haven't had that up until now. And I feel the script over the course of almost a year and many revisions with help from Michael Taylor and Mike Ryan has been able to come to a much further place that, again, is non-manipulative, more character-driven,
mm-hmm.
and but it still is, in essence, the same story.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess he can parse. Somehow he's able to, right? He has that talent to cut through. And but this sounds like a very, maybe it's as a director and a storyteller, you are entering a new phase of your career, or creatively.
I hope so. I didn't go to film school. I didn't go to film school. I wish I had. I kind of just in 2007 just jumped in without any background.
What were you doing before that?
I was a software designer for 16 years. So I would design the user interfaces of both commercial software and proprietary in-house IT systems. So there was there was an intuitive aspect to making sure the systems communicated information to the user in a very friendly way.
Right.
And in a very aesthetic way. And so I worked in user interface design. So like when you use your iPhone and you flick something up and the little thing comes up and bounces a couple times, and there's a very tactile connection between the user and the machine. And that's kind of what I did for 16 years. And in many ways, that was a very kind of left brain, right brain process.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got into film, I approached it very much the same way. The technical brought me in, the fact that you can shoot 24p, it was digital cinema. But I approached it probably too technical. I really didn't have the backbone in some of the things I'm learning now from working with Mike. And it's just taken a while to get here, I feel. Kind of see like the stuff that's important,
mm-hmm.
pulling out manipulative dialogue, expositional dialogue, all these things that just like you do as a newbie without any experience. I've kind of had to learn the hard way, and just to get to this point, I feel like I'm hopefully turning a corner. But there's always the fear that you watch something and you still see elements that you wish weren't there for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes any sense. I'm very self-critical now.
Yeah. I understand that, though. I mean, in other words, good you get, you're going to notice the foibles, the mistakes, what could have been improved. I mean, I think that's just human nature.
To me, the perfect film now is one that doesn't sound written, doesn't feel acted, doesn't seem like it was lit, and doesn't see. It's like it should be an invisible thing to feel. And I feel like I know that I'm still not there, but that's my goal, is to be able to do like something that kind of the filmmaking disappears and you're just left with the story and the characters.
Well, for somebody watching it, it's sounds like the movie that you're describing is the one you get the most lost in.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
You know, and definitely. I mean, there was somebody on, I think it was, in fact, I know it was Jem Cohen. I don't know if you know Jim Cohen. He's something of a, I guess, if to generalize it, an experimentalist, the filmmaker. But he says he always preferred films with unknown actor, unknowns in it, because it's that much more verisimilitude. You know, yes. That you don't have to think. You never think for a moment, oh, Mike, how good. Very arbitrarily choose some actor, but how good Cate Blanchett? I'm thinking, yes, indeed, he's a good actor, but Cate Blanchett, how good she is. No matter how good she is, you're always aware Cate Blanchett is disappearing into her role, but you know it's Cate Blanchett disappearing into her role. So, but that's okay. A lot of people go to the movies for that experience in of itself, so it's legitimate. You know, I'm just saying, but for that particular filmmaker, he doesn't want that experience so much. He wants
That's an excellent point. And that's probably why I respond to like a lot of foreign films, because I don't recognize the actors, sure. So they feel more real. That's a great point.
Right, yeah. They also don't quite put the level of emphasis on celebrity that we do here, where we commodify our actors so much, you know.
But
I think it's ultimately to their detriment. And I think an actor like Robert Longstreet knows that and makes decisions along those lines.
Yeah. Oh, he's been so great to work with. I feel very privileged to have him. He's amazingly talented, and it's like, it's always amazing to me to see a fantastic actor take it. I'm again, not to be self-deprecating here, but to take a mediocre line of dialogue and make it sound fantastic, and you know, no matter how much you finesse a script, for me, I feel like I'm still hearing some lines like, I wrote that. And we're trying to, sometimes you're like trying to fix that. And with Robert, he just makes everything sound natural. You mm-hmm. know, so I'm very lucky to have him aboard and behind this.
Did you you obviously work with a casting
director? Oh, yeah. We worked with Nina Day. It was fantastic. I met her through Mike Ryan. Mike and Maddie, his assistant, who's our associate producer on the project, Mike would...
She's the Italian?
Yeah.
The woman?
Yeah. She'd love it. I would get lists of actors to consider for the roles. And we cast Robert, and then we brought Nina on to help fill out the other roles.
You could work from Robert now that you had your anchor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And Alexia. Oh my goodness.
Oh, Alexia is fantastic.
She really is.
I'm very, very lucky to have her.
You almost have to worry about her being too, maybe too glamorous, kind of on certain level. You know. I mean, she's an actor, so she can
She's really embodying the character of Ellen. It's a tricky character. It's a character, kind of like a Linda Barry kind of graphic novelist who's also a part-time stripper.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to do that kind of transition and kind of make it work, it's a weird little story we got here, but I'm very happy that it's non-traditional.
Yeah. Were there any filmmakers that maybe that, I don't know, inspired your transition or were you seeing things that were you inspiring you, or did you just maybe want to try something different?
I always liked film, and I wanted... Well, my dad died at an early age, so as I was coming up to 40, which is kind of a milestone birthday, I'm going to be 47 this year, I kind of reevaluated what I wanted to do, because I wasn't quite... Even though I got good at software design, I wasn't like really loving it,
mm-hmm.
and life's short to be doing something you don't really love, you know? So I kind of looked back on my childhood and, you know, remembered wanting to be a filmmaker, and that's kind of why I jumped in it for that reason too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and so that coupled with the fact that film seemed to be going digital. I saw that trend early on, long before DSLRs. You know, when I saw that the DVX 100 and the ability to shoot something and edit it on your computer, and it was like low cost. There was something there that intrigued me.
Yeah.
So I kind of, those two things came together to do this. But I loved ghost stories. I do love genre. I feel like that's my calling, is to do ghost stories and kind of cerebral horror. But I felt like I wasn't really hitting the bar of the types of movies that I liked. I like Rosemary's Baby. I like The Shining. You know, I mean, more recent one, maybe like Donnie Darko. These were character driven.
Right. Yeah.
And yet my stuff felt more manipulative.
Gotcha. Well, you may, so maybe this is a good exercise. Regardless, if you go back, you'll learn so much from stepping out of that and using some of the, you know, aspects of this type of film in your future. If you go back to that.
Absolutely.
But I mean, my God, you just named, you know, well, you named a couple of films that transcend genre too. Yeah. That work is just, you know, masterful.
Yeah, there's very few, you know, genre films that stand that test of time.
That are truly scary, yes, yet also just work as great acting,
yes,
you know, pieces, or what, like, you know, a chamber drama like the Rosemary's Baby. It's, I mean,
yeah, and I love another one I love is Tale of Two Sisters, the original Korean version, which is beautiful and was remade, and I didn't like the remake, but that's another beautiful.
What was that remade as?
I don't know. They changed the name, and mm-hmm. and it wasn't very good.
But when was that?
A few years ago.
Oh, okay. So more
the
recent.
The Korean one's the one to watch.
Okay, yeah. yeah. Don't mistake if you hear this. That's for right. The American version of it, but... yeah, there's. I thought you were referring to Sisters or something. You know, Brian De Palma's.
Oh, I love Brian De Palma's Sisters.
Yeah,
you know, that has a lot of split screens.
Yes,
and we're doing a lot of split screens in Missing Girl.
Oh,
I'm
a la,
very
like,
much
like,
influenced by De Palma from his voyeuristic.
Yes,
I love seeing through curtains or glass or in a mm-hmm. mirror. And you couple that with split screen and some mystery. And he's somebody I always responded to growing up.
They also use splits. Well, the split screen is only maybe a close cousin to the comic book.
The
framings,
yes.
and right, yes. You know, in a sense, in terms of that. But yeah, no. So he did. He was able to use split screens. I don't think anybody. People try to obviously imitate it.
We're using some split screens through Michael. With Michael's
right.
genius. In some very interesting ways in this film that allow us to give, I mean, it is.
I think I know where you're doing it, because he's coming up with fantasies in his head about what's going on with Ellen.
Yes.
But we know from that she's actually not going through that experience that he has in his head, that she's going through a very different version.
Yeah, and the whole narrative is really kind of told through a graphic novel. Being that of Ellen's graphic novel, she's kind of creating the story. I mean, that's kind of the external kind of point of view is her point of view. So yeah, the split screens are working out great. I think I'm very happy with that. And I think of De Palma when I think of those.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there was.
He was on the podcast.
He was really yeah. Wow.
Well, yeah, a long time ago. I mean, not that long, but with his last film, which was I think a year or two ago. Passion.
Very cool.
It was on my birthday.
Wow.
And that, I should have said that when I walked in, and I waited toward the end, because he just, I mean, he was a good guest, but I was very intimidated. So but it's because when I mentioned, he goes, get out of here, really? And then he got into, what sign is that? And then he all of a sudden started to talk about astrology, which kind of just sort of changed the tenor of it. And because, you know, he's how many does he have to sit through with these things? And I'm well aware, like, I'm going to a guy that's done 8,000 interviews, you know, not looking probably forward to doing his 8,000 at first. So I was very self-conscious of that.
Sisters is interesting,
though,
because of the two. We're doing a lot of two-camera shooting on this film.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about Sisters kind of... split screen is that many times you get to see, I'm trying to think of that scene where the woman is looking at the window, and we also see what's in the apartment at the same time. So we kind of, it's almost like a two camera view of the world.
Yes, right.
And we're kind of doing that a lot.
Right. Waldo Salt. Isn't it Salt?
Salt.
It's his, Jennifer's, it's his daughter plays the neighbor, the woman Jennifer Salt.
Oh, okay.
She's an actress, and she's in Sisters, and she's the daughter. She was an actress. She's in that. Margot Kidder, of course, plays the sisters. But,
right.
Waldo Salt, I think, is his name. Yeah.
But I do love, you know, you ask me about influences. For me, like, I like Polanski. I like Kubrick. I like simplicity. At the end of the day, when I got into computers, I was like in awe of Apple's product line. I was originally a Macintosh programmer back in, they're now an OS System 10 or something.
Were you like,
I was
like living in Cupertino 6. Or something? Or?
No, I was here. Okay. It was hard. In Connecticut, there weren't many Mac programmer jobs. But I landed a couple, and I was coding in System 6, it was at the time. The next big release was going to be System 7. And then most of the work was on Windows. And back then it was Windows 3.1 was the first big version of Windows.
Yeah, I remember. That was around the time of NT, I think.
Yes, right? Yeah, NT 3.1.
Yes.
And Windows just didn't have the same feel, elegance, look and polish of a Mac. So, and then the internet hit and gave you much more creative freedom over what the screen could look like in a program. And so I always kind of strive to find simplicity in a design from a user interface point of view. So I respond to directors that just use very simple techniques to do things, simple cuts, simple storytelling. At the end of the day, it's like about stripping everything away and getting down to the most simple way to do something. I think that's true of an actor, too, the most simple line.
It's about stripping away.
Stripping away,
I think I've heard
and
Michael talking about that earlier
today. Fat and stuff.
Yes, I got you.
And now I feel like I'm starting to strip away. So
yeah, well, I'm so glad you mentioned your influence by your work in the software, being a developer and a designer. Because I was going to ask you if that had some sort of influence or bearing on your being a filmmaker now, and you answered that. So, it's great to, and it must feel good to always be learning such tremendous things, even as you enter middle age and
it is. I'm really lucky and blessed to have Mike Ryan have helped shape this story and have kind of acted as a mentor throughout. I mean, he's here every day, when I first jumped in, I thought, boy, this is going to be easy. I mean, you just shoot the video and it's on your computer and you can really do anything you want. But you quickly realize it's not easy.
It's not a family vacation video.
No. But it's nice having him here because I can go to him and ask him questions about, does this scene feel like it's working? And I constantly go back to him and ask him for advice on things. And it's like, it's the first time I've had that privilege.
Well, you seem to be very, free of ego.
I wasn't always like this. Right. When I first started, I really felt like you could just point the camera at something, you could write some crazy scene and get an actor, and you're going to make a movie. It was all like, that's it. You know, it's like, I was just thinking technically.
Right.
And maybe that was from my technical background. But now when I look back on my software career, I wasn't a great user interface designer at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I thought, you just put a button here, a couple radio buttons, check boxes here, and it's like the thing works, right? But no, you set a user in front of that, and they don't know what to click on first, what you're supposed to look at first. That became a process that took time, and luckily I got involved in focus groups of having users kind of try the software. Filmmaking, I'm going through a similar exercise.
But instead of audience members, you're surveying. But you're surveying like the producer and the editor. You're not doing a marketing survey with audience people the studios do.
That's right. Yeah. Now it's about stripping away and doing test screenings or surveying your editor, your producer, totally. Mm-hmm. And the readers who read your script. Does this make sense? Does this feel real?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been humbling for me. It's been tiring. This is film number 5 and my last two, I'm pretty happy with. The Midnight Game gets released August 12th, and it's getting released by Anchor Bay. The film before that got released by Anchor Bay, too, House of Dust. That one, I'm a little less happy with it for a variety of reasons. It's a long conversation. And I feel like Midnight Game is, I'm starting to feel like I know what I'm doing a little bit more. And now I'm kind of pulling out a genre, so it's just a lot of work, and it's been 7 years, but I tremendously love the process, and I love production, and I love collaborating with people, And it's been so much more about collaboration than when I think I first started out. And it really is a collaborative art form.
Hey, DeCalvo, learning to play nice.
It's important, yeah. You know, it is. Right. It's like, I do feel lucky that I've been able to work with the same finance team for five films. I've been able to work with the same line producer for five films, the same composer.
It's shocking.
I feel that I have a loyalty and to me it's about working with people and enjoying working with those people. That's everything to me.
Well, thank you. And I hope we can pick up the conversation at the premiere. But, you know,
thank
to kind of
you,
return
Adam.
To...
Thank you for coming up, and it's been great meeting you and having you on set today.
Yeah, thank you.
So I hope I didn't ramble too.
Not at all. Not at all. It's been great. Thank you, everybody. This has been episode number 278 of the podcast. I will be posting some stuff in the coming week or so from South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. So look out for that. And I'm also sitting, while I'm in Austin, I'm sitting with the father of independent films, John Sayles. Now, John was on some time ago with actress Yolanda Ross, but now I'm going to speak with John on his own for an extended conversation. So I'll post that as soon as I can. So I'm very excited about that. And I'm going to also meet up with Hal Hartley in Austin because Hal's latest film, Ned Rifle, which is going to premiere on April 1st here in New York, is having a screening or two in South by Southwest. So I'm meeting up with Hal and maybe one of the cast members. I'm working it out. And many, many more exciting interviews coming up. Also have to fit in one episode coming up in the next few days with the creative team behind Charlie Victor Romeo, as well as the Zellmer brothers, Nathan and David, and their film, Kumiko, the Treasure Hunter, because all these things, of course, are coming out, and I have to get on it. So look out for that, too. And then, as I mentioned, a bunch of stuff from South by Southwest. So let me ask you, have you subscribed to FilmWax Radio on iTunes? Please do. Go up there, but take a few seconds. Holy Moses, please just stop what you're doing. Number one, go to iTunes and give me a star rating. And if you can, please put in a comment about the show. But most important, subscribe, then the star rating. Because those are the two things that move me up the ranks and that help me out the most. And then, of course, you know we're on Facebook at facebook.com/FilmWaxRadio, at FilmWaxRadio on Twitter. And you can go to FilmWaxRadio.com, too. And that'll point you in the right directions for the archive, for all of our, you know, social media and the latest episode, all this stuff. But go to iTunes, please, and share and spread the word. Please, I beg of you. That would be most helpful. If you have comments, there's on the About page of the website that you can send in your comments or your suggestion for guests. That's been happening. Thank you out there for doing that. So thank you for reaching out to me. You can also reach me, if it's important, at adam@filmwax.com, because I care. That is the episode. But and then rent the Maisels Brothers films. Rent everything from Al Maisels you can find. There's even a bunch of his more rare content on Fandor's website. And I plug Fandor, of course, but it's true, it's there, and you can't really find it too many other places. I know that, of course, Grey Gardens is on the Criterion Collection, and that's a lot of fun to own a copy of that. This is episode number 278, which is, of course, in honor of the memory of Al Maisels and all he's done. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back in a few days. This is FilmWax Radio, of course, your independent film podcast, which is presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, thank you so much.